So it is now my distinct pleasure and honor to introduce to you John Sylvanus Wilson Jr. If you haven't heard about him, everybody should have heard about him. He actually served as the 11th president of Morehouse College from 2013 to 2017. And he served also in various functions in the United States Department of Education at George Washington University and at MIT. We were actually really glad to have him as head there, director of foundation relations, and as the assistant provost from 1984 until 2000, way before my time, unfortunately. And during that time, he also served as a teaching fellow at Harvard in the African American Studies program and the Graduate School of Education. His kind of most probably impactful and visible role was in the presidential administration of President Barack Obama. Obama actually appointed Wilson to head the White House Initiative on Historically Black Colleges and Universities. No? So he served as a liaison between higher education institutions and the federal government. There's much more to be told. I should also say that it has been an absolutely pleasure to meet John Wilson in a very different context somehow. As he is actually very busy, I am glad to say that we managed, I think it was only last week, no, that you finally said, I think I can do this. And that we could confirm the program. And I'm very delighted to give the word to you, John, and take as much time as you want. We really are looking forward to hearing what you have to say in this momentous moment. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Can you all hear me? Okay, good. I that's good. Thank you, VPK. I want to thank VPK and I thank Otto Scharmer. VPK and Otto are two of my favorite people at and beyond MIT. And they are responsible for my being here today. I think this is a very important topic. And I want to share a few thoughts with you this morning on the theme, the unfinished business of higher education. But I want to be clear with you about my view of the humanities by insisting that the unfinished business of higher education is the business of the humanities. And conversely, the business of the humanities is the unfinished business of higher education. They are one and the same. What that means is you will not find it difficult to see yourselves at the center of everything that I have to say today. I came up in a liberal arts environment at Morehouse College, and I continue that through my graduate education at Harvard. I think humanities are more are very important, and they're more important now than they've ever been. Even as I say that, I'm aware, well aware, that they are being, the humanities are being backgrounded in many ways. And I'm gonna talk a little bit about that. I see the humanities as very critical. If you see this next slide, the business of the humanities has everything to do with the decision was just made in this country. Can you all see that? Okay. I think I was just with some students here at MIT last night, and the bewilderment in the room was poignant. It's a mix of students, including international students, and the international students, two of them in particular, asked me to explain how this country could have made the choice we did. They did. I didn't have a cogent answer for that. But as I was talking with these students, it became very clear to me, and I made it very clear to them, these are students who are in engineering and computer science, and they spend a little time in the School of Humanities, but I think they're going to be spending more time there, because I said the people in the humanities division are the ones who are going to be telling us who. They will answer that question about how this country did that. And the people in the humanities are the ones who can best tell us who we might yet be. And that's what I really want to zero in on with this. From two heroes of mine. First is, that's John Dewey. And John Dewey said in 1916, democracy has to be born anew and every generation, democracy has to be born anew every generation, and education is its midwife. That's a lot of pressure on education. And in my view, education has not done a good job at midwifing democracy. And I reference only briefly the election this week. The other quote I want to anchor this talk in is from, there you see him, a hero of mine, James Baldwin. James Baldwin said in 1962, the poets, by which I mean all artists, are finally the only people who know the truth about us. You bear witness to something which everybody knows and nobody wants to face. Only an artist can tell, and only artists have told since we have heard of man, what it is like for anyone to get to this planet and to survive it. And then later in the speech, and this is a speech called The Artist's Struggle for Integrity. You can find that online. You go on YouTube and plug in James Baldwin and The Artist's Struggle for Integrity, and it'll come right. It's one of his more remarkable speeches. He says in that speech, the pain which signals a toothache is a pain that saves your life. Now, I didn't understand what... And... I was fortunate, though, because in 1984, I was finishing my doctorate at Harvard, and the woman who I was dating, who would soon become my fiance, was finishing her doctorate at MIT, and she had a conference in France, and I went with her. And we were there in France, and I was... I'd finished Divinity School at Harvard and the Graduate School of Education. And there before me was this man, and that was James Baldwin. This was in 1984. That's the picture we took. Can you see that? That's a picture we took on the street in Paris. And I have to tell you all, I had just read, being in graduate school, everything James Baldwin wrote. I knew him inside out. And I conducted myself in this moment as if I had just seen Jesus. So I, Mr. Baldwin asked, where are you all going? And I said, we were just hanging out. And he said, well, I'm going to a club to hear a friend of mine sing. And won't you join me? And for the next 3 hours, I had some face-to-face time with James Baldwin. I sat right next to him. It was just Carol, who you see here. She is now my wife. And we had several other students from graduate school. But I, as I said, I knew James Baldwin inside out, and I dominated the time with him. And among the questions I asked him was that one question, What did you mean when you said the pain that signals a toothache is a pain that saves your life? And I had told James Baldwin, he asked all about me, and I told him, he asked, why did you go from Morehouse to Harvard Divinity School? I said, well, I did that because I'm the son and grandson and great-grandson of preachers. And I had a friend who, in high school, who was from the Baha'i faith, and according to the Christians I was around, he was going to hell, and I didn't believe that. So I wanted to study the history of religions, and I was on a mission to understand what all religions have in common. And that's what I did at Harvard Divinity School, and I talked a little bit about that with him. And he said, well, I want you to understand something. When I said the pain that signals a toothache is a pain that saves your life, I'm talking about you, and I'm talking about everyone else who are artists, who are writers, who are thinkers. He said, our job is to, we have two functions. We have to disturb the peace, and we have to remake the world. And we are the only ones who can do it. The business people won't do it. We are the ones, the people in the humanities. You are the ones, is who he was telling me in 1984, who have the work of disturbing the peace and remaking the world. And he said, as you do it, you have to recreate yourself because we need more artists, more thinkers, and more writers. You have the language, you have the concepts, you have the vocabulary to clarify for humanity our brokenness, and clarify also for humanity what it means to be whole. That sounds like a lot of pressure, and I hope you do not experience it that way, because he didn't mean it that way. He said it's an honor to do this work, and if you read him, that was the work he was doing. This comment is a pain that saves your life. Is the business of humanities, and it's the unfinished business of higher education. So with that as backdrop, I want to give you kind of a mandate with this talk. Those of you who are in humanities, and borrowing from both Baldwin and from John Dewey, I want to borrow from Dewey's point about midwife, being a midwife. And I want to make three points. First among them is the humanities should be, must be the midwife of a new integrity, a new integrity. And by that, I mean for our institutions, for us as individuals, for us as a country, and eventually a world. Again, you're going to sense that I'm putting a lot of pressure on the humanities. What do I mean by midwife, a new integrity? There's always been a tension in American higher education, AHE, American higher education, between doing well and doing good. You all know, because you know the history, that American higher education, for one, to produce under American higher education. It was imparting a Christian construction of reality. And we know because of recent revelations that many of these early American institutions have now confessed that they were not only intimately involved in the economy driven by human enslavement, but many of the men who presided at American campuses, including Harvard and Princeton and Yale, owned enslaved Americans. So how much morality could there have been if that's what the start was? My son attended Princeton. Princeton did a report that showed, that confessed that they had a slave auction outside of the president's home several times at Princeton University. That's how invested they were. And you see all of these institutions taking their names off of the names of slave holders off of their buildings because they were the ones with the money. They drove the economy. And I could do a separate talk about that. Well, we morphed from doing good, at least that was the handle, to now doing well. And it's been a split. And some, I believe it was Sherry in her opening talked about the humanities and the tension between the humanities and the sciences. Well, the shift is pretty thorough. And I've come to see it as pretty symbolic. And there are two symbols I'm going to share with you just to illustrate why we need a new integrity. One of the most remarkable graduates of, I'll say, white higher education or higher education in America, at least, is this man, Bill Gates. And I was working at MIT in the 80s, late 80s and then into the 90s when his wealth was building and we were tracking his wealth. He was becoming the wealthiest man alive. He's now been overtaken by Elon Musk, as you all know. But I want to point to a moment when Bill Gates came back to Harvard University in 2007 to serve as commencement speaker. Bill, computer science and engineering. And then he went on to be Bill Gates. But he came back in 2007 and he spoke to the graduating class, and this is what he said. He said, "I left Harvard with no real awareness of the inequities in the world and the appalling disparities of health and wealth and opportunity of people to lives of despair." Basically, what he's saying is I came out of Harvard blind to all of that going on in the world. I recently wrote a book by Harvard, at Harvard Ed Press, called Hope and Healing, about HBCUs. And in that book, I asked, why didn't the civil rights movement in America happen 100 years before it did? Graduates and the students at Harvard and Yale and places like them pull off a civil rights movement right after Reconstruction went down. And the answer to that is because Harvard has always been educating people, and as Bill Gates said, causing them to be blind to so much that is going on to the world in the world. And I focus my book on HBCUs, which had a different kind of ethic. And here you see Martin Luther King. Well, he's a graduate of Morehouse College, where I graduated from and where I presided. And while he was there, his president, Benjamin Elijah Mays, you all know him, we need more Ben Mayses in this world now. He was the president of Morehouse College, and he commissioned these young men. He made them see everything Bill Gates was blind to. And the latest biographer says that Mays would send a small army of his young charges, the confidence and connections to attack injustice at a time when fear of reprisals deterred many from doing so. He sent set out to empower students, and he charged a young man with changing the world. A Morehouse man, he made clear, was a special order and had to bear a special responsibility. That's the Morehouse I attended coming out in 79 as well. Martin Luther King came out in 1948. As I clarify in my book, what Morehouse and Howard and Spelman and place that Harvard and Yale and Princeton were not doing was they were sending people out with a dual competency. They were giving them a skill set for a better me to get a job, and a mindset for a better. They were making them aware of everything to which Harvard graduates, and Harvard is symbolic here, everything to which they were blind. And I'm insisting to you that that dual competency constitutes the integrity that higher education must have. It's not enough to be focused on hyperjobism. It's not enough to be focused on doing well. You have to get a sense and a sensibility about doing good as well. So I want to share with you now a symbol of where higher education is now and the ethic that dominates. Because I've been on the board at Harvard, and I was senior advisor to two Harvard presidents, and I spent a lot of time on that campus. I've also spent a lot of time on the MIT campus. And we have a hero's problem. Who wants to be like Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg or Elon Musk? Wealth, we're in a wealth chase. And it reminds me of a film back in 1987 that captures where we are now, especially if you consider the election that happened earlier this week in America.
It is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind, and greed, you mark my words, will not tell our paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA. Thank you very much.
Okay. That constitutes what I think is an ethic now. All students are not under this pressure, but many are. And the New York Times has been writing about this. And if you take the long view, our campuses were once resting places for the inquisitive, but they are now breeding places for the acquisitive. That is a problem. And the way to solve that problem, the way to fix that, is you, everybody in this room. The humanities division is uniquely situated to illuminate who we are and who we must yet be. I want to insist on this. The data are compelling. The Washington Post reported recently that humanities enrollments are down 45% since 2010 at several key campuses, and it's said to be a national phenomenon. Two-thirds of college students have reported feeling overwhelming anxiety, and from 2010 to 2020, the number of those battling depression has doubled. You all are the bearers of meaning. If you do your jobs well, we can solve this, and that requires you to elevate in the American university and in the university in general, and not to be on the margins. So I'm putting out a mandate for this, because our integrity will be rediscovered or discovered for the first time. Division, do their best work. All right. So in addition to midwifing a new integrity, I want to turn to midwifing a new self-awareness. Because everything I just talked about, if you consider it, there are very few people in and around higher education who think that what I have described is a problem. And our job on the humanities side of life is to eliminate the degree to which it is a problem. It is a problem. It's very problematic. I started my career here at MIT. My wife was not finished with her PhD, and so I decided to turn down a job going south and take a job at MIT. And we lived on campus as well as we were called housemasters. And Kennedy's division at MIT had, compared to my Morehouse experience, the humanities division at MIT had a minority voice. They were not as prominent. They were dominated by the sciences and engineering. And I took a look at the history of humanities. MIT was born in 1861. And it was not until 1932 that a humanities division was even stood up. That's 71 years. And it was not a major and did not become a school until the 1950s. So that's almost a century into the life of MIT that we're without a significant humanities footprint. And they debated the whole time, and it was resisted because they didn't want to become compared to Harvard. So they had to be unique, and they resisted humanities. I'm here to tell you, people here are still paying the price for that resistance and that marginalization. And there's another scene that comes to mind that illustrates the degree to which we need to cure the self-awareness of people, not just in MIT, I'm not picking on MIT, but in American higher education. I want to turn to 1974, a film by Mel Brooks called Young Frankenstein. Marty Feldman plays Igor, and Gene Wilder plays young Frankenstein, and they are just meeting. And this is might be a little off color today. Look at what happened when they were first meeting, Igor and young Frankenstein. Here's what happened. Here's their encounter.
You know, I don't mean to embarrass you, but I'm a rather brilliant surgeon. Perhaps I could help you with that hump.
What hump?
Okay. Young Frankenstein is talking with someone who is blissfully unaware of the degree to which he has been disfigured by his experience. I want to contend that American higher education has been disfigured by its lack of emphasis on the humanities. And it's blissfully unaware of it. When I tried to broach these issues at MIT, the response was, what hump? Okay? And I believe that is happening in general as well. And what hump, the equivalent is, what inequality? We now elected a president who does not believe in climate change. Well, that's what hump. What climate change? What poverty? What suffering? What genocide? People don't define things that are obviously, from a moral and ethical standpoint, a problem. They don't define them that way. And it is our job to bring about, to midwife, a new self-awareness of our brokenness. And only by doing that will we discover a new pathway to our wholeness. All right, now I'm going to wrap up in just a few more minutes by giving you the third challenge. In addition to humanities being the midwife of a new integrity and a new self-awareness, I insist that you have to be the midwife of a new mindset. And I want to say three new mindsets, and I have them at the end of my at the end of my book called Hope and Healing. The last chapter is a recommendation to higher education that we take on the challenge of shaping students with a new mindset, and there are three kinds that I'm pushing for. So I'm going to walk through the three right now, and then I will close. And as I promised, I'm going to close with my discovery at Harvard Divinity School of what all religions have in common. All right? So the first mindset that I'm asking for your cooperation to help be the midwife of is a destination mindset. And I'm drawing from W.E.B. Du Bois, a brilliant man who lived to age 95, but at age 72, he realized that he had made a mistake, a serious mistake in his life. And it's because of the way he perceived the world, and think of the way our students perceive the world now. He said, I didn't sufficiently question where it was going when I was younger. And then he wrote this in his autobiography, Dusk of Dawn. He wrote this at age 72. He said it was as though moving on a rushing express. My main concern was as to my relations with the other passengers on the express and not to its rate of speed or its destination. That is a significant problem in American higher education and in higher education worldwide. Too many people enter American higher education, and I mean the students now and the faculty, with a seat mentality. They're only trying to get a good seat. And this is the careerism we have. The aspiration, the goal is to get a good seat. And they think too little, as Du Bois discovered about himself, of the train speed or the train's destination. We need a destination mindset, and we are overrun by people with a seat mindset. I want you to understand that the best way to impart a destination mindset, and this is making the shift from a skill set for a better me to a mindset for a better we. That mindset for a better we is a destination mindset. The best way to do that, the best people to do that, are the people I'm talking to at this humanities conference, because you are the ones with the language to do it. So that's one of the three mindsets. The second mindset is what I call a second day mindset. And I made good use of this as president of Morehouse College, because it's a quote from Mark Twain. And Mark Twain said, the two most important days in your life are the day you're born and the day you find out why. We have 8 billion people on this earth. That means 8 billion people have had their first day. But only a tiny fraction of humanity has had their second day. That is to say, there are very, very few people who are living with a true sense of being aligned with what they were called to do. This is a significant problem, especially in American higher education. Because again, as I said, you have too many people coming to try to become wealthy. They're not following their heart. You and I have met people who, what they do, that you can just stand back and say, wow, she was born to do what she's doing. X or Y person is doing what they were born to do. You know people like that. They have such a passion, such a drive. They're so into it. Morehouse College was a second day institution for me. And when I came to Morehouse as president, I was trying to recover some of that second day value. We need people who are living a call answered life. A call answered life. And the only way to live a call answered life is if you find out why you're born, you have your second day. So we got a destination mindset, a second day mindset. And then finally, and I close with this, a string shooter mindset. Now, this is a longer story, And I draw from a good friend of mine, a man who I insist is in his 80s now. He is the wisest man alive. I could tell you a lot about his story. Suffice to say, he was brilliant. He was born in Ghana as a prince. The people in his Ghanaian village, this is in the 50s, noticed that he was very smart for his age. He was ahead of where everyone else is. So what you did at that time in Africa is you sent the kid to the colonial school, right, where the neocolonial folks were sending, where the whites, the Europeans who had come down in Africa to send their kids to school. Well, he blew them away. And he said, no, you need to send this one to America. So he goes to Groton. And I've seen the yearbook in Groton when he was there. He blew them away. He went to the top of the class. And then he goes to Harvard and finishes Harvard in 3 years, knows 6 or 7 languages. It's one of these phenomena. He's a genius. And he was going to be a revolutionary, but decided to write books. He decided to go the way of humanities. And I handed his first book was in 1967. It's called, and check the title, The Beautiful Ones Are Not Yet Born. The Beautiful Ones Are Not Yet Born. I handed that book out to all freshmen at Morehouse in my first year as president. In the subsequent years, I handed out this book, The Healers, because I insisted to my young men that no matter what your major is, you ought to want to be a healer. And I was speaking your language out of humanities, but I was really speaking out of Armand's book, The Healers. And this is a story about Africa when the Europeans were first coming in and bringing all the alcohol and gold and corruption in order to take Africa's land and natural resources. You all know the story. And this book features one of the villages that was trying to resist the European values coming in. And in this village, they had their own competition, like Olympic-style games. But they were gradually, over the years, being corrupted by the Europeans who influenced some of the competitions, and that's what they did in these games. But there were some resistors. And one is the protagonist in the story. His name is Denzu. Denzu was... like Ikwe Armand, brilliant. Ikwe and I are very close. I'm visiting him for now the 6th time. I'll go to see him in January. He's in Senegal now. And this protagonist is in these games, and it's a couple weeks long competition, sports competition and mental competition. And it comes down to the final contest. And the final contest, 3 players are left. And this is a contest where the judge ties a bird, a pigeon or a dove, to a kite string, about 300 yards of kite string. They will send the pigeon or dove in the air, and the contestant has to take a gun and shoot it. And the contestant that can shoot it with the fewest bullets, this is a marksmanship competition, will win, will become champion. So whoever is champion of this competition becomes the champion of all the games and is celebrated, etc. Well, Denzu resisted the values of this this game. You have to crown one person. The ethics they had before, it's a cooperative thing. You don't celebrate one person, you just celebrate the idea of cooperative competition. But he was trying to convince his contestants, but everyone wanted to win. So it came down to 3 people. And the first contestant takes 3 shots. And on the 3rd shot, he blows the bird out of the sky. And then the next contestant does it on the 2nd shot. So then it's Denzu's turn. And the judge takes the bird tied to the kite string, and it lets it go up 100 yards, 200 yards, and roughly 200 yards. He says, fire. And Denzu waits, and he looks at the people he's trying to convince that this is wrong. And he looks again, he looks at the judge, and then he takes aim again with a smile on his face, takes careful aim, and you hear the gunshot. And at first you see the bird lose some altitude, and then it takes off even higher. And Denzu throws the gun down, and the judge understood what happened. He goes, "What did you do?" And Denzu said, "I lost your game." And the judge said, "You lost on purpose." And Denzu said, "I lost your game, so that means I'm not your champion." And everyone realized what had happened. What happened was, instead of shooting the bird, Denzu deliberately shot the string that freed the bird. Instead of preserving control, he released it. Instead of taking a life, he liberated one. With that move, he tried to send a signal to everyone around him. And this is what I told the Morehouse guys, to be a string shooter. Instead of being just another player, go out and change the game. It is harder to shoot the string than it is to shoot the bird. So you have to do something that's far more difficult, those of you in humanities. But you're the only ones who can do it. You have to be string shooters. You have to redefine what it means to be whole, what it means to be human, what it means to live a meaningful life. With that, I'm at time now, so I want to close by sharing with you, as promised, what all religions have in common. But I'm not going to tell you what it is. I'm going to show you. Because the friend who I met freshman year at Morehouse College and who taught me to use film clips instead of just words, his name is Spike Lee, Shelton Lee. You know him as Spike Lee. And his third film depicts a scene that reveals what all religions have in common. And it's not hard to figure out, so I'll just hit play, and then I'll end. All right, here we go.
Who's latest? Let me tell you the story of right hand, left hand. It's a tale of good and evil. It was with this hand that Cain iced his brother. Love. These five fingers, they go straight to the soul of man. The right hand, the hand of love. The story of life is this. One hand is always fighting the other hand. And the left hand is kicking much ass. I mean, it looks like the right hand love is finished. But hold on, stop the presses. The right hand's coming back. Yeah, he got the left hand on the ropes now. That's right. Yeah. Ooh, it's a devastating right and haters, huh? Man, hey, KO'd by love.
Okay, that's what all religions have in common. That in the end, when the smoke clears, everything's gonna be all right. And I want you to understand as I close that it's only the humanists, only you people in the room can clarify that even though everything's gonna be all right, that should not be left to chance. It should not be left to hope. And it should not be left to others. You have a responsibility to commission us all to be the midwives, but of new mindsets. So as Dr. King would say, we can make of this old world a new world. Thank you very much for your attention. Be string shooters.